So, the recorder is switched on, and I think the crackles have gone away. Okay, are y'all ready then?
I'm ready.
Okay. So, Barry, I've enabled the recorder. Would you please confirm that you grant me permission to record our conversation for use in my course? And, of course, I'll provide you with a courtesy copy for your reference.
Yes, that's fine.
Thank you. Okay, Barry, let's begin. This is Francesca Durham, and I'm here today with Barry Stevens, international artist and author, and today we'll be discussing mandalas. Hello, Barry, and thank you for joining us all the way from Wales.
Hello, Francesca. Pleasure to be talking to you.
Yes, and thank you for taking the time to receive my call today. Okay, Barry, let's just dive right into our subject matter today, and the focus is on mandalas. Can you give me your definition of a mandala?
Well, on a basic level, a mandala, you pronounce it mandala, which is correct, but I always tend to pronounce it mandala. It somehow flows easier for me to say mandala.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh.
So the correct pronunciation is indeed mandala.
I do wonder sometimes, but that's interesting to note. Okay.
Yeah, that's how the Indians say it. I would say a mandala is an image which facilitates centering, as in the centering of consciousness. It facilitates a meditative state. It brings the mind to stillness. So having said that, some mandalas quite obviously affect consciousness very differently from others. Some are more stilling by nature, and some more have a more dynamic, energizing quality. But speaking generally, it's about an image which brings into the consciousness of the viewer the awareness of the center.
Okay. Okay, nice, nicely put. I do find that everybody seems to have a slightly different explanation for it, but I'm always looking for a very clear interpretation of someone's ideas on the whole mandala and the creation of them, which will lead me into my second part to this particular question, and that is making reference to your book, Sacred Circles, which I have recently read, where you describe a mandala as being, and I'll quote you on this, a personal journey in that the mandalas are painted by individuals in a particular time and place, and it's a transpersonal journey in that the principles which are an integral part of the mandalas are universal and timeless. It's a beautiful, beautiful statement. But to your average individual and somebody who is just getting started with mandalas and understanding them, what does this statement mean, and can you explain that?
Well, for a mandala to bring the viewer into the awareness of the center, their own center, the universal center, a mandala has to have what is a universal quality. The center is universal. It's not personal or specific. It is, in that phrase that you quoted, transpersonal. It's beyond the individual. And for a mandala to work, it has to have a strong quality of that universal transpersonal energy. But at the same time, if an artist is painting a mandala, to a certain extent, that mandala is colored by the specific energy of the artist, which is also colored by the time and the place, and the energy is generally prevalent at that point in time. So in that respect, a mandala always has an element which is beyond time and space, which is universal, and also an element which is in time and space, which I'm referring to as personal.
Okay.
Because, as you know, mandalas come in an infinite variety of forms.
Yes.
But they have a common quality which brings them all into the definition of a mandala.
Okay. Okay. Which will bring me into my next question. I'd like to know a little bit more in how you feel about creating a mandala as healing and what it can do in so far as healing and being therapeutic, and what do you think about that and why?
Well, the first time I really came across the mandala was when I was a teenager, and I was very interested in psychology.
Uh-huh.
And that brought me into contact with the work of Carl Jung, and
uh-huh.
Carl Jung did a lot of work with mandalas, both in his own life and also when working with his clients or patients.
Uh-huh.
And what he felt was that when the people he was working with started to find balance within themselves and started to integrate the parts of their psyche which were not flowing too well together, this thing which he called individuation started to happen, meaning it all started to come together. And at that point he said that his clients started to, one, have dreams of mandalas, and two, started, it spontaneously came into their artwork, because he encouraged people to paint and draw. And that was my first encounter with the mandala as a healing energy in the context of psychological healing, so to speak.
Oh, okay. And this started, as you had mentioned, as a teenager for you.
It did.
When you started exploring with mandalas. Mm-hmm.
Well, I didn't actually, wasn't really focusing on mandalas at the time. I was making I was getting interested in psychology.
Psychology,
and
yeah.
And that happened to make a reference to mandalas, but I wasn't really honing strongly into mandalas at the time.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
That happened later on in my life.
Okay.
Not a lot later, but a little bit later.
Mm-hmm.
But I think most people would agree that although the psychological aspect of mandalas is very fundamental, it's also widely used as a kind of background energy to enhance a holistic sense of well-being, which is a rather sort of vague statement. But what I'm trying to do is move it away from a psychological sort of perspective,
okay,
to a more sort of general one,
mm-hmm.
because people working in all kinds of healing spheres mm-hmm. in the modern era use mandalas as a kind of supportive energy, because from my standpoint they always remind people, whether it's the person on the receiving end of the healing or the person giving the healing, that everything is one whole. And this for me is the sort of fundamental healing insight that is an essential part of the healing journey.
Which is
in recent years, a lot of people have been using mandalas in color healing. I also worked with astrology for a while, and I tend to, at that point, I always placed the chart in the context of the mandala and saw the chart as a mandala.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So in my life, it's always been there, and it's always been something which reminds me of the center, reminds me that everything's interconnected.
Mm-hmm.
And in that respect, I regard it as a sort of fundamental healing energy.
And as you had said, which is synonymous with the spiritual path.
I would say it is, yeah.
Yes. Okay. Now, can anyone create a mandala? And if so, are there any steps or processes involved that one must do?
Well, I tend to assume anybody can approach painting a mandala.
And I don't mean, obviously, of course, on a professional level, but to read about it and be inspired and then to create. Is it that easy to do?
Well, my experience of this is giving workshops.
Yes.
And I think I've yet to give a workshop and someone has said, I can't do this, you know.
Huh.
Seems to be able to do it.
Mm-hmm.
It's an art form that children quite often spontaneously do. I mean, it's not a like, you know, if you're doing a life drawing or something, you have to sort of almost work hard at kind of representing what you're seeing, whereas this is an abstract art form, and this mandala has abstract qualities. So it's not like you're aiming for a particular end.
Okay.
You can do a free-form mandala, which doesn't have to be geometrically exact, for instance.
I like your statement where you say it's not for a particular end, and I think that sums it up quite nicely for people to know that it just is what it is. It is what you have created, and there isn't anything special where you need to finish it off.
That's right. I mean, if you give people space, they, generally speaking, enjoy being creative. But because of our social and cultural conditioning, there are kind of blocks to creativity. But if you say to people, well, there's no good or bad here, there's no mandala which is right or mandala, if you give them plenty of space just to be free and express themselves, generally speaking, it happens.
It happens.
And people discover their ability to make all kinds of, I've known people be absolutely totally amazed by what they've done. Because they thought, well, I'm not an artist, I can't paint. But just given this space to explore and to play, and in the background energy of the mandala energy, which is meditative in its nature,
right,
something wonderful has happened. So, you know, I can't categorically say everybody can paint a mandala, but my experience is that given the opportunity, people do. And all kinds of, I think you've looked at my, well, you have looked at my website, and I've put up a lot of mandalas painted by people on workshops, and people are incredibly creative.
They are. They truly are. And definitely through this form of art, I find that people can let their mind wander and just come up with something absolutely beautiful. I was inspired just from reading some books and doing some research. I thought, well, let me have a go at this myself after I've read some books. And what am I taking away? What am I remembering? And I had shared with you some of the things that I had come up with, not really going in depth and not taking too long to actually create them, but just doing it literally on a whim, what I felt at that moment in time. And I found it quite interesting to look at what it represented in terms of what I was going through and experiencing in that moment. Certainly, if anybody's familiar with the types of books that I've been reading, the creative expression that comes from it is fascinating.
Yeah, and your phrase, on a whim, is a good one, because a lot of creativity inspiration comes out of a spontaneous, carefree state of mind. So in some ways, like facilitating that in creative expression is almost the essential starting point, I find. Though later on in the process, often people do want some like a technical advice. But for the creativity flow to flow, you do have to have that sort of on a whim mentality. And I found earlier in my life that some of my most interesting drawings came out of what is called in the English language doodling. You know, it's like,
oh, absolutely.
It's like the mind is just sort of floating freely and things happen. And that can be a very good starting point for ideas coming from the unconscious or from another level of consciousness into the conscious awareness of the person concerned. So I find when helping people to paint mandalas, it's very, very helpful to start with a meditation and just to sort of get to a point of stillness and allow that creative energy to flow from that point.
And when you say start with a meditation, is that a long process, or is that just clearing one's mind?
Well, generally speaking, in a group context, what I like to do is chant Om, partly because that kind of harmonizes everybody in the room. It's a beautiful thing to do anyway.
Okay.
It's a very lovely, peaceful, strongly meditative energy. But if you're in a group and everybody's chanting Om, somehow that brings the group together. And then follow that with a period of silence. Not everybody who comes on my workshops is used to long periods of silence, and they like the chanting of the Om followed by the silence.
Oh.
I sometimes also use visualization and suggested certain images or certain ideas, which is a sort of, people can take them or leave them in terms of their own meditation and also their creative process after the meditation. But that is also sometimes helpful to people to have a bit of direction. But I try not to give too much direction because that interferes with people's individual journey, so to speak.
And speaking of direction, you talked about meditation and giving them just enough direction. What about giving them tools to use? Do you think it is best for people to just draw without maybe more than a ruler, if even, or with the compass, or are these specific tools that should be used all the time? How do you feel about that?
Well, some people seem to manage very happily with not much use of geometrical tools, but generally speaking, when people start to create a circular design, at a certain point they start thinking, well, this would be a lot easier if I had a compass.
Okay.
I mean, you know, you can do it without a compass, but it gets, the more complex the design, the more difficult it is to do free form. And once people start working with geometrical instruments, there is a kind of, you know, there's a satisfaction with free form, and there's also a satisfaction with exactitude. They're a kind of yin and yang in a way. It's like painting is always freehand in my case, and the actual drawing up of the mandala is a combination of geometry and freehand.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
It's almost like a left hemisphere, right hemisphere quality. I think all classical mandalas do have a geometrical component. I'm not sure if I would go as far as to say it's an essential part of a mandala, but the kind of perfect balance and the perfect symmetry is one of the universal qualities of the mandala, I would say.
It's interesting to note that you say that. Would you say that it's necessary to have that?
No, I'm just thinking that if you look at the mandala, I mean, some are more obviously symmetrical than others, but if you look at the sort of classical, well, having said that, there are certain mandalas which have a definite asymmetry, which is actually intentional.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I'm aware that the ones you painted that you sent to me, I don't think you used a compass, did you?
I did for the one that was, I think it was all circles.
Oh, right.
Yeah, it was an orange one, and it was full of circles all around the outside as well as the inside. However, when you start to color these in, I was using that more as a base or a foundation to start from, because it's not as though you're going to be able to stay within the lines, and that really wasn't what I was thinking about at the time, is, oh, it has to be perfectly circular, you know, it's, because when you move it away from you and you look at it from a distance, I must say, and I'm not sure if you would agree, but they always look better when they're a little further away. When you bring them close, unless they are quite perfect, then you see all the little imperfections, right? You're laughing because I know you know what I mean.
Yeah, well, some people like to go close. I mean, I had this friend in Scotland, and we used to draw mandalas together. And he used to, like, work on an A4 sheet of paper, which is not a very large piece of paper. Uh-huh. He used to then say, I've got to walk about 100 yards away to evaluate this. But I have a friend who, when she comes to look at my work, she gets very close to it. What you see, as you say, you don't see it in perfections. You see something different altogether when you're closer to it.
You do.
You see the whole image in its totality when you're far away, and the closer you get, the less that is the case. You know, if you were to theoretically get to very, very close, the area you would see would be very small.
Right.
But yes, I mean, I'm in a room which is about 20 feet long as I'm talking to you, and that's quite a good distance to look at a mandala, I find. So it does depend, obviously, how big it is.
Right. Right. Well, I know for myself, my boards are 8x8, and that's more than enough for me to actually fill them with my own creative ideas or intentions. So.
Is it 8 feet by 8 feet? Is it?
The ones that I did?
Well, when you say 8x8...
Oh, no, 8x8-inch boards. Small. They're small. No.
Yeah, are we talking inches or feet or what?
Inches, yes.
Okay, they're small.
They're very tiny. Are you kidding me?
I thought, well, they must be feet.
No, absolutely not. Take a ruler, 8x8.
Okay.
Yeah, but then again, just enough to explore and experiment with. I think an 8x8 board is good for that.
I used to travel a lot, and I carried with me a pad which was 4x4 inches, which is even smaller.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And I did do some mandalas of that size. So I don't know why. I just thought inches would... I wasn't sure what dimensions you were talking about, quite honestly.
Oh, okay. Well, now you know. Well, that leads me to my next question, Barry. I wanted to know where you draw your inspiration to create the beautiful mandalas that you do.
Well, I think in a sense the inspiration has been constant in its source, but we're dealing with quite a long period of time now, because I started painting mandalas in about 1973.
In the 70s, mm-hmm.
Which is over 34 years ago. But so at a given point in time, I would be having different ideas and different inspiration, but the basic inspiration is my feeling of affinity for the circle. And as you remember, I said in my book, the circle came to me very strongly when I was about 18 years old, when I was having an experience of, for want of a better word, a transcendent experience or oneness. And I was thinking, well, there's no way the mind can get a handle on this. There's no words that can describe this or explain this. And I thought, well, how can you connect the ability to communicate with this experience? And I was thinking, well, this is not possible with words. And at that point, I saw an empty circle, and the intuition arose that this is the perfect symbol to express this state, because the circle is whole, complete, and perfect. And it was just a sort of insight. It wasn't something that I'd thought out in any way. And then that the circle just came more and more into my artwork, and until eventually I didn't seem to be and don't seem to be able to really give much energy to painting anything else. I always gravitate towards the circle because it's so strongly associated with this quality of energy which has inspired me all those years, which is basically a sense of oneness.
Okay, well, that's interesting.
I think personally it's what inspires mandalas generally, though I might be wrong there, but I think that that's As you know, the mandala is strongly associated with all the mystical traditions, the esoteric traditions.
And
I think we can be fairly certain that it's because the mandala is a symbol of the one.
And getting to the center, I suppose, is how many would see that.
Well, if it comes from the center, it helps people resonate with the center or tune into the center.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you asked me earlier what my definition of a mandala is, and
mm-hmm.
I suppose I'm talking about that again, really. It's got to have a quality of energy and a vibration that sets in motion that sense of oneness, that unity. But that is the inspiration. But if you take mandalas I painted, you're reasonably familiar with my work, so you can see that there are quite a few different themes which have occurred over that 30 years.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You made a reference to my rainbow series, and that wasn't always with me, the rainbow. I mean, for a while I was working with a relatively small range in the spectrum, and that was what was inspiring me at the time. And then the full spectrum and the rainbow came to me, and I thought, this is what I want to try and incorporate into my work. And then another time I started working a lot with spirals.
Different
themes have come along at different times in my life, associated with different ideas and inspiration.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm just going on to my next question, because everything sort of connects one into the next. But what happens when you introduce color then into the mandala? Like, where does it all begin for you? Is it always a drawing first, and then you fill it in with color? Or do you work with the paints automatically and create?
Well, technically speaking, in terms of the actual physical process of creating a mandala,
mm-hmm.
in my case, I do draw it up in pencil,
okay.
or I actually paint it. But in my mind's eye, that may not actually be going on. I mean, it may. That's the way I do it technically.
Technically, yeah.
But if I'm sort of in exploring ideas in my mind, so to speak, it's a different. Those two, the color and the image, isn't sort of broken up into colors and pencil marks, so to speak. It all happens. What goes on internally is not necessarily exactly the same as what goes on when I start
painting.
Creating it.
Okay. Oh, okay. So when you're technically drawing, are you thinking about the colors you're going to incorporate, or are you saying that you'll do it, you'll draw it up first, so it has the outline or the layout, and then it gets filled in with just whatever comes to mind, or how does that happen when you start introducing the color? I mean,
I generally do have some idea before I start working on a mandala where it's going,
okay.
of line and color.
Mm-hmm.
But when I actually, I'm having to sort of think a bit now, because to really talk about this, I have to think of the last time I originated a new mandala, because I quite often make hand-painted reproductions of my work, which I definitely know what I'm going to do before I do it.
Okay.
But in terms of originating a new mandala,
yes.
sometimes it goes off in a direction that I don't necessarily know about beforehand, and might have sort of some doubts about whether it's going to work out. And I tend to let that happen because I found that if I'm setting off in a certain direction and something else starts to happen, then it's a good idea to go with it, basically. Even though I may not be quite confident that it's going to work out. In fact, sometimes it doesn't work out, but it then leads to something which does work out.
It leads to something that does work out.
For instance, when I first started encountering this, sometimes there can be a an element of, you know, you can start off with a clear idea of what you're planning to do, and it can, in some sense of the word, fall apart. And I learned through experience that that's actually quite a good idea, to let it fall apart and then see what comes out of that.
Oh, really?
In other words, and what it facilitates is a new image arising. Because otherwise there's a tendency to stay with what you know, or to stay with what you're familiar with. And I suppose, you know, you could draw parallels with this between sort of normal life, really. But,
right.
You know, the willingness to basically go where you haven't gone before. But mm-hmm. In terms of painting mandalas, you have to... I find that to get to a new space, the one you haven't been before, you sometimes do have to really not know quite exactly what's happening. And so I tend to stay with it when that occurs. It doesn't happen, you know, every time I paint a mandala, but occasionally it happens, and I've learned that that's an interesting process. And if I'm giving workshops, and you know, it's quite often other people experience this, they might, you know, might say, well, I'm really not sure what I'm doing, or how do I resolve this, or usually something comes out of it. You just have to stay with it.
Right, right. And you make mention of giving workshops. Tell me about the workshops that you do. I find them quite interesting, and I know you have some pictures on your website of groups that have been brought together. And obviously everybody looks like they're having such a great time, but how many people do you bring into your workshops? Do you work one-on-one with people, or is it always in groups?
I have worked with one-on-one on a
few
occasions, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm going on a sort of longish journey, which has been the case in recent years, then there generally needs to be quite a few people the other end to sort of make it all work in terms of the organizing of it. So, you know, sometimes there might be 30 people or something. Sometimes there might just be...
Did you say 30?
Yeah, I think...
Wow.
Last year I was in Eastern Europe, and I have been there a few times now.
Uh-huh.
I think sometimes they... I've sometimes given workshops with larger numbers, but it gets a bit sort of... it's difficult to connect with everybody when it becomes a larger group. But a comfortable number is probably about 12 or something, and,
right.
And you know, it can be bigger and it can be smaller. When my work started to circulate in printed form,
yes.
You know, which was in the 80s, really,
mm-hmm.
People, you know, you build up a network, and some correspondence starts to happen, and a few people started to say, well, they'd really like to take part in a workshop or arrange a workshop. And so over the years, a number of workshops have happened. You know, it doesn't happen like month after month or something, but it happens a few times a year usually. I haven't given workshops beyond Europe. It's either been in the UK or a few countries in Europe.
Right, right.
It's like a context in which to meet people and also to share with them my understanding of mandalas,
mm-hmm.
and to help them create mandalas and also explore what arises in the context of mandalas, because it's an art form which, I mean, I think probably being creative generally opens people up. Generally speaking, in the context of a workshop, people do have ideas and feelings to share and explore.
Right.
So there's an element of that which goes on in workshops as well, apart from or as well as the artistic activities, so to speak.
Right, and you make mention that, for instance, one of the recent workshops, there was a request for the students to be shown how to create, is it called the Chartreuse Labyrinth?
The Chartreuse Labyrinth, yes.
Oh, I know, I've seen pictures of it, and it's absolutely beautiful, but from your notes, something we had previously previously discussed. It led to the group creating a large labyrinth, and on the final day, as you say, walking it, I mean, that is being spontaneous, and that is something, an art form, taking on a life of its own. That must have been a really wonderful workshop.
Yeah, I think it was. It was a small workshop, but it was a workshop in the Orosoma Centre in Lincolnshire. And I don't know if you know about Orosoma, but basically it's a system of healing which focuses on colour. And I was introducing various mandalas because of that particular workshop. They were keen to be shown how to draw up various traditional or classical mandalas,
okay,
including the Shriya Yantra, which is the most famous one in India, and then the Chartres Labyrinth. And the reason I know about the Chartres Labyrinth is, one, I've been there to Chartres.
Oh, you have? Mm-hmm.
A truly amazing experience. You know, it was. I'm not sure what the situation in Canada is, but in Europe we do have these amazing cathedrals, and you know, some of them are very, very. They're very, very big, and you sort of look at them and think, well, how on earth could people have built these with so little technology so long ago?
Right.
Staggeringly beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing really to compare with in the modern world. And Chartres Cathedral is perhaps the most famous cathedral, and it has these staggeringly beautiful rose windows, which are examples of the mandala in the west. And it also has this very large labyrinth on the floor. And I'm not sure whether people historically walked it or not, because you know, some in some respects Christianity is a bit ambivalent about all of this,
uh-huh,
in terms of the sort of mystical dimension of symbols, and the labyrinth goes way back. I think it goes back, I'm sure it goes back before the time of Christianity. But anyway, it's a very beautiful and inspiring symbol to work with. And this group, first of all, we drew it on a small scale, and then they decided to do it on a large scale. So on the last day, we made a large labyrinth, which was big enough for people to comfortably walk, and had it became a ceremony.
Nice.
And
I believe that one dates back to, if I might add here, it's 1200 BC, that particular one, that labyrinth.
I don't honestly know.
You know? Oh, okay. The only reason I make note of that is because recently I found and realized we actually have an artist in the Burlington area that has created a take on that particular one in a park nearby here that I actually went to, I think just 2 or 3 days ago, to see it for myself. So, and just, you know, knowing that that's the kind of workshop that you have given, or you've led a group, and that is what you have created because you went with the flow. I just thought it was something very beautiful to know that you could actually come up with the idea and then create it and then actually go through it or experience it.
Yeah, I mean, it happened partly because there was one or two people in the group who were very adept at working out how to do these things.
Okay.
I mean, there was... I mean, it takes... Group energy is a bit of an unknown quantity until it happens, and it turned out that one or two people really had a good ability to grasp how to do this and to actually help it along.
Oh, wonderful. Mm-hmm.
Because when it comes to drawing some of these classical mandalas, it does help to have a bit of a... sort of understanding of, it's a certain kind of, it's it's a geometrical it helps if you have a natural feel for geometry to do something like a labyrinth, like the Chartres labyrinth, anyway, because you get simple ones and complex ones.
Right.
So on this particular workshop, there was someone who was very sort of enthusiastic about it and seemed to be very good at working out how to do these things and was able to help everybody else. I mean, I showed him, but then he showed everybody else. So it just sort of flowed very easily.
Wonderful.
But, you know, it wouldn't happen with every group I've done.
No. Interesting. Okay, well, I just find that very, very fascinating. I just wanted to make sure we did touch on that a little bit, because it is one of the, I'd have to say, more well-known types of mandalas or mandala creations, that particular labyrinth that we've spoken of. But I am going to move on to the next question that I have, and it's more in regards to your travel. Of all the countries that you have visited, if you could tell me a little bit about which one gave you the most inspiration and why, and would you say this country also influenced your design patterns and choice of colors that you've used in creating your mandalas?
Yes, well, I think the most influential country on me in terms of mandalas and also the spiritual journey in general has been, as it has been to many people, India. It's like a lot of us feel a spiritual connection with India, even if we haven't spent a lot of our lives there, and even if we wouldn't necessarily want to spend a lot of our lives there, or recognize that India isn't the easiest place to sort of to live,
right,
for all kinds of reasons.
Right.
But nevertheless, it has a very strong and powerful spiritual energy. So.
And how long did you spend in India, Barry?
7 months.
7 months.
This was a long time ago.
Uh-huh.
When I was in my early 20s.
Have you been back?
Sorry?
Have you been back, or have you
already? I don't know. I often think about it, but I just don't get around to it.
Right.
And I have all kinds of reasons why that is the case. You know, it's like, in some respects, my life here is a very peaceful, meditative life. And India, however inspiring it is, it can be quite a chaotic place to sort of spend time in. But anyway, when I went there, and there was actually a build-up to going there. I mean, I was there for 7 months, but I was sort of tuning into it for years.
Right.
And I remember thinking when I got there that I was almost, like, I went to the sacred mountain of Arunachala in southern India, which was the place where Ramana Maharshi lived, though he'd already died before I got there. But I used to meditate on his teachings and on this holy mountain and would experience very, very strong energy. This was when I was living here in the West.
Oh, I see. Uh-huh.
And when I got there, I was very glad I went, and I am very glad I went, but I also felt that the spiritual connection that I had felt before and which I have felt since wasn't really dependent upon being in a given geographical location.
Okay.
And I had a very sort of clear understanding of that when I was at a certain point when I was in India. But anyway, for a few years building up to going to India and being in India, I was very and have ever since then been very influenced by Indian philosophy and to a certain extent Indian art. So I wouldn't say my mandalas are, in any of the sense of the word, like traditional or classic Indian yantras. I say clearly aren't.
Okay.
Though actually the mandalas that you find in India are very, very varied, and they're not necessarily like, for instance, in the temple that I first went to, in the inner sanctum, the central part of the temple, I found carved into the stone a six-pointed star. And we don't think of that as being a classic Indian mandala or symbol. But there it was. You know, I thought, well, it's a Western symbol, but it you find it all over the place in India, and also the cross is a very, you know, you find it. So the concept of a sort of classic Indian yantra or mandala probably needs to be loosened up quite a lot to make any sense, really. And on the streets, for instance, they do all these patterns, which I think you could probably quite easily find in the West, and you wouldn't really know that they were specifically Indian. So I'm not really sure whether I've been that influenced by the actual Indian symbols, but I do think that connecting with Indian culture and Indian philosophy did deepen my understanding of the mandala in its essence.
In its essence. And I think maybe what I'm picking up from what you're saying is you don't actually have to be in another country to get that, probably a gut feeling of being connected.
No, I mean, you know, if you're tuning into something which is universal,
mm-hmm.
wherever you are, there it is.
Yes, wherever you are, there it is. Yeah. It's not that easy to understand when you throw it out that way so easily for somebody to grasp what that means, but I certainly understand what you mean.
Yeah, well, I mean, it either makes nonsense or it makes perfect sense.
Right.
But, I mean, we go on these journeys, and, you know, I'm in favor of us all going on these journeys, whether you call them pilgrimages or whatever,
mm-hmm.
but somewhere along the line, you do start to, the deeper you connect with your center, the more you realize that it's like an option rather than a necessity. You know, when I went to India, it wasn't really an option. It was something that I felt, well, this is what I have to do. And it was with a kind of deepening understanding of being there.
Right.
And I realized, well, what drew me to India is in fact universal. And, you know, back to your question, I found lots of inspiration in lots of countries.
Right.
Everywhere, basically.
Right.
Huh. And, you know, I live in West Wales,
uh-huh.
and it's here as well. It's not so much a part of the indigenous culture in the way that, like India, wherever you look, there is. The spirituality of the culture is very sort of deeply embedded in the day-to-day life. It's
right.
Probably more so than other countries I've been to. But once you start to tune into the mandala and the essence,
mm-hmm.
it just crops up everywhere.
Right, right. Interesting. As elemental parts of the design, let's say, used in your rainbow lotus, I've seen it, and those that I will be doing workshops with myself will also be exposed to it, but you use the yin and the yang symbol with the lotus flower, and I wanted to know if you remember how you actually chose the colors for that particular scheme. And I've been so drawn to your work, and I believe it's because of the colors that you tend to use. I find there's certain colors almost throughout quite a few of them, they're so beautiful. But that one in particular, I mean, do you remember how you came up with the color scheme for it, for the rainbow lotus?
Yeah, I remember. I mean, I remember fairly in clear detail how all the mandalas came together. I mean, this is going back. Rainbow lotus originally came together in about 1980, probably. And it grew out of a line drawing.
Mm-hmm.
And the line drawing featured in it myself and my girlfriend of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And she had given me a pendant of the yin yang and was very, very sort of tuned into the yin yang as a symbol.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I was due to meet her in somewhere 100 miles away from here, sort of halfway between where she lives and where I lived. And I got there the night before, and I drew this mandala in pencil, and it was a line drawing.
Okay.
It had myself and her in it, an energy coming from the ground, and then through our bodies and our hands, we're reaching up to form an arc. And where the hands met, there was an Om symbol.
Right, right.
And in the middle, there was the yin-yang as a symbol of, you know, oneness and harmony. And that line drawing remained like that for a year or two, but then suddenly various things happened, and I got it out again.
Yeah.
And I constructed it using geometry and compass and so on. And then I removed the two people from it because I tend towards abstract mandalas, uh-huh. rather than mandalas with recognizable people or objects.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And then very, very quickly, these colors came together. Now, I think the rainbow, in fact, it was such a sudden happening and such a change in my style that some people were truly amazed. They thought, well, this is almost like a different artist. And just how this happens is an interesting question, you know, whether my conscious mind worked out those colors. I mean, clearly, I mean, the lotus underneath the horizon goes through the spectrum, and the rainbow above the horizon obviously goes through the spectrum. So,
right.
The main and the yin-yang goes through the spectrum. I think I must have been, on some level, trying to incorporate all the colors of the rainbow and put it together. But, you know, it just happened. It wasn't something that I thought out or even could have thought out.
It just came to you because you were going with the flow and using that particular energy to bring it all together.
Yeah, I you know, sometimes when you're going with the flow, as you say, you actually don't really... You don't really, almost don't have any choice about it. This happens, sometimes when I'm painting, it's almost like, the word people use is channeling. There's an element of that which sometimes goes on, you know, and it's like, I think I was as amazed as anybody else when I painted Rainbow Lotus.
It was absolutely beautiful, and as I said, I mean, I'm definitely going to be sharing that particular one when I'm dealing either one-on-one or in a workshop environment. I just found the colors they're so inspiring, they're breathtaking, just the whole picture itself is a great piece also to meditate on, just to sit back and to look at that image and reflect.
Yes, it has touched a lot of people. And
is that one design that you're often asked to recreate?
Well, yes and no. I think in some ways mandala designs of mine kind of become active, especially when they originate. It's almost like the process of me painting them in the first place is... It's part of one, me connecting with the energy, and people I'm connected with also connecting with the energy.
Hmm.
And I don't think anybody's asked me to paint Rainbow Lotus recently, though I have painted a lot of times, and I did sell one, I think, 2 or 3 years ago, a large one, but it's not a commission I've had recently. I've had commissions to do other mandalas, but not that one. But you never know, it might come around again.
Yeah, well, it is a beautiful piece, so I just want to make sure I mention that to you, because I found I was very drawn to that one. And I also wanted to know if you have a clear idea or a message when you are creating a mandala that you want to get across to people. Is there a message in your work?
Well, there is a message, and there is a feeling, and there is an energy. I mean, to actually paint the mandala, you have to be in tune with the image. You have to be feeling what the image embodies. And I don't know whether I, strictly speaking, do this for Well, I do in a sense do this for someone else when they specifically ask me to paint it for them. But some of these mandalas happen sort of, it's just me working at the easel, so to speak, and something happens. I'm not necessarily thinking about who will look at it or who won't look at it, whether people will feel this or feel that. With Rainbow Lotus, I wasn't kind of thinking about what it might mean to other people. I was just being creative in the present moment.
Right.
I mean, it's interesting when you use words like meaning
uh-huh.
and message.
Uh-huh.
It's quite difficult to use those terms without implying directly or indirectly a certain separation or a certain duality. Whereas the mandala is very much about everything is one, all beings are one. So it's more about like, well, a message might be conveyed, but it's not something that I as an individual is conveying to another individual.
Right, no, I understand.
But, you know, if you look at another of my mandalas that you've mentioned in our correspondence, like Sacred Centers, for instance. Now, a lot of people see a lot of ideas in that image, and they're obviously there. You know, I mean, some people see mandalas as a kind of language, that there's information in there.
Mm-hmm.
There's like philosophy in there. There's teachings in there. And,
right.
And I'm sure that's true. But I think the essence of enabling this process to happen is not really to be thinking.
Right.
You for instance, said you paint from the heart when you paint your mandala. I think that's the essence. You have to be feeling it and communicating it, but not going into the concepts about it.
Almost having it pre-planned.
Concepts are there if you go looking for them, but they don't come as a result of conceptualization. They come
right.
from a deeper place.
Right.
But yes, certainly there are ideas, and mm-hmm. there are in some sense the word messages.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not something that it's not something I work out beforehand.
But okay.
It becomes evident that it is that they are there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I could look at all these mandalas, because I've got a few in this room, and I could say, well, yes, people see this kind of meaning in this particular mandala, and I can see that, yes, it is there.
Yes, it is there, but I think what you're saying, in essence, there is not an intention to get that message across or to get it out.
Well, I think it happens anyway, you see.
Right, right.
And I think the less you are sort of I think the essence of communicating deeper understanding and creating beauty
uh-huh.
is really more about surrendering and letting it happen through you,
right,
rather than kind of working it out in your mind.
Right. No, I think that's well said. Okay, now, moving on to my next question, Barry. In your book, Sacred Circles, you make reference to the unique qualities of the circle. We've talked about this a little bit earlier in our conversation as well when you spoke about, I think it was probably going back to when you were about 18, and the feeling that you were having at that particular point in time, is this your favorite shape to use in your designs, in your mandala creations?
Well, the Sanskrit word mandala translates approximately as great circle, so I would say the circle is And every mandala directly or indirectly incorporates the circle. Even if you have a point of light emanating from a center and there's no circle,
right,
the circle is indirectly stated by the symmetry of the lines, assuming that they are symmetrical.
So it's always there.
I would say it's always there, but, mm-hmm. but sometimes it's more obviously there than at other times.
Okay.
And there are sort of modifications of it. But in my early work, the circle was clearly defined, especially in my line mandala, the black and white ones.
Mm-hmm.
And then when working with paint, I explore, one of the effects I like is moving from one color to another very gradually, so you get a kind of smooth flow. And if you have a series of concentric circles or a movement through the spectrum or tone in a circular form, you sort of sense there's a circle there, but you don't actually see it very clearly.
Mm.
It's more like
yes.
a kind of circular glow.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that's perhaps my favorite kind of image, an image in which the circle is there, but it's not in any way defined as beginning at this point and ending at another point. It's a
right.
kind of expansive circle.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if it's strictly speaking a circle, if it kind of expands like that, but that's an image I've worked with a lot over the years. And sometimes it expands through the spectrum, and sometimes it expands through different tones. Like I think you've looked at my series, which I call Shanyasa Color Light Variations.
Oh, I wasn't sure on the pronunciation, but what you said, Shanyata?
Shanyata. Again, I'm not sure if that's the Tibetan, you know, way mm-hmm. they pronounce it, but it's the way that I have pronounced it so far.
Mm-hmm.
And with all of those, the circle is not clearly defined, but they are circular and they do have a kind of glow about them.
Yes, they do.
And those I have actually worked with a lot in the 90s and through into more recent years because people do find those very meditative in their effect. They kind of, they vibrate and they also disappear, which is an unusual thing for an image to do. So I've done, you know, you asked if I'd been asked to paint rainbow lotus in recent years. Not really, but I have been asked to paint a lot of shanyasas
oh.
in different colors because I explored moving through the different tones of the rainbow
right.
and the effect that had.
Well, I've enjoyed reading your book, Sacred Circles, and I wondered if you have plans for a new book in the future featuring anything new or any of your latest creations. And I know Sacred Circles can be found on your website, which I'll let you refer the listeners to a little bit later on. But are you writing anything new?
Well, I am writing things new, but I haven't actually sort of collected any of it together.
Uh-huh.
It's like the reason I felt motivated to put Sacred Circles together at the point in time I did was partly because I was involved with a group project to be making a mandala video.
Oh,
and then
okay.
when I started writing, and then I sort of got into it, but I collected quite a lot of ideas from previous
uh-huh.
writings going back a number of years. In terms of recent years, I have said quite a lot of about mandalas to quite a lot of people, as I am to
right.
you now, but I've never really recorded it.
Right.
You know, like workshops are very stimulating in terms of this sort of discussion and,
right.
and exploring ideas, but I've never bothered to record it. I've
well,
thought about it, but I've never got around to doing that.
Well, this will be interesting for you.
Well, definitely, yes. And I have got I got quite a number of designs which are not in Sacred Circles. But
would they be all up to date on your website, Barry?
Pretty much.
Pretty much, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Not entirely, but yes. That's easy to keep up to date with.
Right.
That's the wonderful, one of the wonders of the digital medium. You can paint a mandala, take a photograph of it, and share it with everyone
immediately
on your website.
Right, right.
But I can't honestly say I'm in the process of preparing for a new book at this point in time. I have had discussions about it with one or two people, but it's not high on my list at the moment.
Well, Sacred Circles is a wonderful, if you want to call it a quick read, just to sort of invite yourself in to go exploring on this wonderful journey where you lead us from place to place and tell us about all of the things that you got up to at different points in time, whether it was in the 70s or in the 80s or in the 90s. So I was quite fascinated, and I thought it was a great read. So that's why I was wondering if there was anything to follow. But having said that, I have noticed that you use rainbows in your work, and I would just like to know that if you've ever been inspired to create a mandala just from seeing rainbows, given all of the journeys you have taken, all the countries you have visited, I'm sure you've seen amazing rainbows all over the place.
Well, yes. It's interesting how different images, one, appear in your life at different times, and not only appear in your life, but speak to you. Because I'm sure I must have seen rainbows as I was growing up, but I don't really remember seeing rainbows.
Interesting comment, yes.
But I definitely remember seeing them and thinking about them when I was living on the small island, the Isle of Iona, off the west coast of Scotland, which is the sacred island of Scotland. I don't know if you know about Iona, but it's the place where all the kings of Scotland were buried, and where Saint Columba, who brought Christianity to Scotland, established his monastery.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of these incredibly naturally mystical places. And the west coast of Scotland is incredibly beautiful. You get these mountains, you have these islands, and you have the ocean. And rainbows seem to occur there rather a lot. It might be vibrational, it might be part of the magic of the place, or it might be that there's a sort of mundane explanation in terms of water and sunshine and so on. But anyway, there I saw rainbows, and I remember taking part in a conversation with some friends, and this person was saying how rainbows are one of the wonders of nature. And that was the first time I really remember thinking about rainbows. I mean, I must have seen them, but I never thought, yes, they are truly incredible. And it coincided with me living in a house with someone who had a glass crystal which put rainbows all around the room when the sun goes through it. So I started thinking about rainbows. I don't think I'm not sure if I was painting the full spectrum at the time, because I was very tuned into a particular part of the spectrum, the gold, the lilac, the blue.
Okay.
And I wasn't really tuning into the reds and the oranges and the yellows.
So it wouldn't have been deliberate?
It wasn't deliberate.
Okay.
No.
Mm-hmm.
But rainbow lotus came together in about 1980, so that would have been about 4 years after. So it might have been that rainbows had been kind of making their presence felt in my psyche for several years before finally I started painting them.
Right.
But no, I've certainly never sort of seen a rainbow and gone home and painted one. But another image I do remember seeing, which is related to the rainbow, is what I call spectra, which is like a ray of light which has all the colors of the rainbow in it.
Okay.
You know, sometimes that happens naturally. Light bounces off something and you see a spectra. And I remember thinking, gosh, I really would like to paint that, because it's a ray, and I was using a lot of rays.
Right.
And it had these beautiful colors going through the whole spectrum. And I did incorporate that idea into Electra, which is, I don't know if you're familiar with my design, Electra, but it's another one which I have painted for quite a few people over the years. And that does have all the rays emanating from the center do move through the spectrum. So that is an example of me seeing something and thinking, yes, sooner or later I want to paint that.
Right.
I don't have a conscious memory of that thought to do with rainbows. But nevertheless, I have incorporated the rainbow and the full spectrum into a lot of my work, especially during the 80s. I think it was mainly in the 80s. I was really homing into the full spectrum and the rainbow as a theme.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because there's another one called Rainbow Spiral. I don't know if you know that one. But I'm looking at it now, and it's got a spiral formation in the middle of a six-pointed star. And that also goes through the whole spectrum.
Oh, okay. It brings to mind many of them. I have many of the ones that you've painted in the back of my mind. But probably the Rainbow Lotus and is it Sacred Centers? I'm confusing the Sacred Circles with Sacred Centers, in our previous communications. That's what was happening there.
The mandala itself is called Sacred Centers because it's got the chakras represented.
I think that one is fantastic from a woman's perspective, or from my point of view anyways, to look at that and, well, to be aware of it and know what it represents. It's a fantastic piece. It's really beautiful.
It's interesting you should say from a woman's perspective. Is that because you feel it has something specific to women?
I think for me personally, when you understand how vitally important it is to know about your energy centers and what's going on.
Right.
And how to tune into making sure that they are fine-tuned and working well. That was my whole interest, I think, and why I was so intrigued when I actually saw it. Initially, the first time, it was like, wow, look at that representation of your energy centers. As you're mentioning and calling them chakras, I sort of float between the two words. But it meant so much for me. And then to see it and how beautiful it was laid out in your mandala creation, I thought, wow, it really took my breath away. And it definitely something that I thought was very, very beautiful to be able to sit back and meditate on that image and reflect on that image and the importance of it in its wholeness, in its entirety, as one. And we keep always coming back to that one particular word, one.
Yeah. I almost, thinking about that, Madala, I almost did think that one out. I mean, I think a lot of it was coming from somewhere else as well. And because the reason I put it out was because someone asked me to do a design which incorporated certain principles.
Ah, okay. Mm-hmm.
But for instance, some of it I hadn't thought out. There's a blue circle and there's a yellow circle on the same level as the green heart chakra, or heart center.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't think about yin yangs traditionally have that circle in that position. But I realized more recently that the yellow circle, which is on the left, if you're looking out from the mandala, corresponds to the physical heart chakra, and the blue corresponds to what people call the spiritual heart chakra on the right, which I certainly hadn't thought about when I was painting it.
So even the blue that you mentioned, the color is so striking and brilliant and just fantastic, the way all of the colors flow one into the next. And as I said, just to meditate on that can almost bring one a sense of peace and calm. And it's even more important when you can actually understand what it means.
Yes. I mean, there are two levels to appreciating mandalas. One is I suppose it goes back to my original definition. There's the universal aspect, which is, in a sense, beyond the mind, and it is about pure essence. And then there's something more personal, is not quite the right word in this context, but more relative something pertaining to the relative world and our understanding of the relative world.
Definitely. No, I completely agree. Completely agree. But having said that, I'm just going to move on to the next question that I have here. Since we're talking about and exploring all the different styles, your particular style of mandala creations, many cultures have their own unique styles of mandalas. And as we've previously communicated, there's the sand mandala from the Tibetan Buddhist monks, and then there's the Hindu yantra from India, the medicine wheel, which is representative of the native North American Indians. And of course, we've got nature's own types of mandalas. I wanted to know if you have a favorite, and if you do, why? Apart from your own, of course.
Yeah, well, in a sense, my own aren't. I mean, they have something similar with quite a lot of other mandalas, but I suppose a theme which has been with me right from the beginning is the theme of light.
The theme of light?
Light.
Okay.
As in radiant light.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes back to my early meditation experiences, which are not necessarily that different from what they are now, but
okay.
It's like going into the light, as in meditating and this brilliant energy arising in consciousness. And that was something I always thought, well, I'd like to try and represent that. And of course, in nature, that is represented in a very obvious way by the sun. So, of course, we can't, generally speaking, look directly at the sun. It's not advised to do.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of us do look at the sun when it's rising and when it's setting, and we think, wow, that's so beautiful. It's partly because the sun in itself, but it's also everything which happens around it and the context in which it happens. So I think I can probably say that my favorite mandala is like luminous energy in all kinds of forms, but especially that kind of radiance that such images have. And the sun is the most obvious example, but you know, I wouldn't say that's my favorite mandala, but that principle is my favorite principle.
Well, you mentioned luminous energy and the light. I can definitely see how that applies to your actual work, and I'm just thinking of a few of them off the top of my head, because I don't have them sitting in front of me, or I'm not sitting in front of my computer right now.
Mm.
But I can definitely see how those images come through in your work.
Yes, I mean, and in terms of how that relates to the kinds of mandalas you mentioned,
uh-huh.
I mean, a lot of a very obvious example of luminosity shining through the mandala is the rose windows.
The rose windows, yes.
And that, of course, is largely dependent upon the sun being around somewhere. So, for instance, in Chartres, I think it's true to say, they have a rose window facing in four directions. So at different times of day, different windows light up. And then they come to life.
Right.
And the colors become very brilliant. So that's an example of this principle of luminosity and radiance being brought into a traditional form of mandala. But somehow people managed to create this luminosity anyway. For instance, I went to a sand painting mandala by some Tibetan monks a few years ago, and the colors they used do kind of emanate light, and that's quite a skill as an artist to bring life into a two-dimensional image, to bring luminosity into it. So basically,
right.
If any image sort of incorporates that, I tend to like it. And I do like a lot of mandalas which actually don't incorporate that. But probably in terms of what is my favorite, that is a favorite theme.
a favorite reoccurring theme for you.
Yeah.
You mentioned
luminosity and radiance.
And you mentioned having seen the sand mandalas coming together. That must have been an incredible sight to see.
It is extraordinary. And
just given what's involved in the creation and putting it all together, and just the ritual that it is in itself.
It is like a whole experience. I mean, as you probably know, when they create these mandalas, it exists in the context of a lot of chanting, a lot of meditation.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I think probably that's true of most mandalas. They have to have some of that to convey the energy. I mean, you talked about the meaning and the ideas. Well, the energy needs, for that energy to be conveyed, it needs to be cultivated. And in the context of these sand mandalas, they do a lot of chanting.
Uh-huh.
as part of the process. But it's incredible skill involved, and they work as a team.
Uh-huh.
And they create what is almost hard to believe. You sort of look at it and you think, well, this is almost impossible to believe. It's so extraordinary.
Right.
And then what is also so extraordinary is that they then sort of sweep it up and throw it into the nearest river.
Right. I don't know if I can ever understand why they do that, but I understand why they do that, but for the project itself to just go away being swept up so easily, that's how fragile life actually is, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I suppose I was being a bit flippant there, but basically, the way they create it is it takes sort of 12 days or something.
Yes.
And then they remove it relatively quickly, but they do so very carefully.
Yes.
And then they take it in some an urn or something like that to the nearest river, and then there's more chanting and more rituals, and there's a very profound idea behind it. And the idea is that the energy of the mandala enters into the water and flows into the ocean and then evaporates and falls as rain, and they refer to that as the rain of blessing. It's like, it's not just putting it into the nearest river and that's the end of the matter. It's like, it's bringing it into the whole flow of nature.
Uh-huh.
There's a very, very beautiful idea. And it's an example of sharing your creativity in a very organic sort of way. I don't do it. I mean, I don't work with sand mandalas, but I can see it's a very... I can understand why they do it.
Right, right. Well, you have a publishing company that's been around since 1983, I believe, called Mandala Prince.
That's right.
And tell me more about it. It's still in operation today?
It is.
Okay.
And basically, it started with three of us. In 1983, and it's myself and my two friends, Mike and Claudia Booth.
Right.
We now work with Aura Soma, though...
I have more questions for you on the whole Aura Soma, but we'll get into that another time.
Yeah. So anyway, we were living in the same house near the town of Glastonbury, which... is a very amazing place in its own right.
Right. Uh-huh.
And we started to publish a few designs, like half a dozen designs, and then gradually the collection built up over the year.
Over time. Uh-huh.
Well, mainly at the moment, it's my work that I'm publishing, though I do meet up with Mike and Claudia, and we do, we have shared a few creative projects together over the years, and the whole printing medium has changed in the last 20 years, as you know. So in the beginning it was all litho print and printing thousands of everything, whereas now it's more like I can use a lot of different images and print smaller numbers using a modern printing method.
As in
digital printing.
More so print on demand.
That's right.
Right.
You can, But it's been with me for 23 years now, and it's been very much a part of my day-to-day life. And I assume it will continue to be, and it's how most of my work has been circulated, really. Now, in recent years,
wonderful.
People have been reproducing themselves with my permission. And, you know, they found their way onto CD covers and book covers and so on.
Right.
So...
One of yours might find their way on the front of my workbook. I haven't decided where I'm putting it just yet. But there's two that I'm, like I said, I'm really taken with the Rainbow Lotus, but also... with sacred centers, just I think for the Rainbow Program overall and what I'm doing and working with women in transition, the sacred centers almost sums up everything that they will experience going through the workbook. So, yeah, I think we can definitely see that being featured somewhere, whether it's on the front or the back or somewhere in between.
Yeah. I mean, that mandala, I did attempt to represent, I don't know whether you've seen the detail around the side. There's also the astrological symbols around the side.
I have picked up on that.
Yeah.
And this particular group, they're also fascinated with astrology and their signs and what it represents. And when you look at it, And everything that has gone into that particular one, there's a lot of information there. But like I said, you have to sort of know what you're getting into. You have to know what you're seeing in order to appreciate everything that's gone into it, which you just sort of, I don't think you did that one on a whim. One day you got up and said, you know, I'm going to do this. I think, as you mentioned, that was created over a period of time.
Yes. It wasn't a long period of time.
No?
I mean, sometimes ideas come through very quickly, and I think the best ideas often are like that. But I wanted to place the individual, the idea of an individual as represented by the energy centers, in the wider context. Which is represented by the astrological signs. It was like the microcosm and the macrocosm sort of principle.
Right.
That was one of the principles anyway. And another idea I've got there is that the yin-yang as defined is in a pink color. I don't know if you've noticed that. You know, like the actual shape of the yin-yang.
Yeah.
Is a pinkish color.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And that was definitely had to be that way because I wanted that color is preeminently associated with divine love, and I wanted the whole yin-yang to have that quality. But again, I'm not sure I thought that one through. It just had to be that way.
And it just came about. It just happened.
I don't think any other color would work, you see. Right?
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's interesting when you think about, like, design and symbolism. Mm-hmm. It's almost like it has to be that way. And then you think, well, if it has to be that way, did I make any design choice, or was it just the way it had to be?
Right.
And that's... You know, if I look at a lot of these mandalas, like you couldn't change the colors around. They just wouldn't make sense.
Well, you know, Barry, that all of my students are women in transition facing life-changing events, and I'd like to know what advice you would have for them when they begin to work on their own personal mandalas. Again, you know it's going to be a fairly small artistic adventure for them, but what advice would you have for these ladies?
Well, advice is an interesting idea, and, you know, I've got to put myself into the situation, and I wouldn't initially give any advice, really, apart from...
The reason this question does come about is because a lot of them have already expressed the fact that they don't paint. I'm not an artist. I don't know how to draw.
Right. Okay. Well, that is a common obstacle, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
I think the first thing is to make it clear that this isn't a sort of a question of, like we said earlier, there's no preferred end result. It's just an exploration.
And, right.
And there should be no sense of... I think what I would say, you have to, like, I kind of explained earlier how I help people or enter into this sort of process.
Okay. So where did I leave things? I had asked you, is there anything else you'd like to share with us today?
That's right. This discussion seems to have sort of gone quite quickly, and sometimes I think, well, am I going to have anything to say to answer all these questions? And sometimes I think, well, I'm just getting going, and you move on to the next question. So it's an interesting sort of yin-yang, that one.
Yes, it is. I like how you summarize that.
But, I'm very happy to talk to you. I'm always delighted to discuss the mandala, and I think it's wonderful that people are interested in the subject, and more people, it seems. And I'll be very curious to learn how your workbook turns out and how this all works out for you.
Oh, wonderful. That's great, Barry. I'm sure the listener really appreciates your advice and all the information today about mandalas. Well, that's all we have time for today. I mean, I'd like to say a very special thank you to you, our very special guest, Barry Stevens. And Barry, if our listeners wanted to find out more about your wonderful services, where should they look? For instance, where do you have a website?
Well, I'm fortunate to have the mandalas with an s.co.uk domain name.
Okay.
That's fairly easy to remember. Mandalas with an s.co.uk.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And it's all there, really.
And it's all there. Well, this has been Francesca Durham of francescadurham.com, and this concludes today's featured interview.